Interviews with Wireless Pioneers. This is in four parts. The first three parts were interviews conducted at the convention of the Society of Wireless Pioneers in San Mateo, California, April 19, 1975. Part four is an interview with historian Thorne Mays at his home in Saratoga, California, on April 20, 1975. Now, part one. Ray Luby, I've been told by a number of people in Northern California that they heard you doing a radio program way back in 1909. Now, many history books say that broadcasting didn't start in the United States until 1920. How in the world was it possible for anybody to have heard you doing a radio program in 1909?
The answer to that is real simple. There were a lot of experimenters playing with wireless telephone, and there were several methods tried, and some of them worked and some of them didn't, and they were not good enough until Doc Harrell came along with this idea of putting in the ARC system and creating a carrier wave that would handle the voice and put it out over the air just like Spark Radio originally was. And you would hear the voice rather than any other thing. Even the carrier wave was almost indistinguishable because it was of such a frequency that it was inaudible to the human ear. That's the reason behind it.
Well, Doc Harrell did it. Who is he?
Harrell was a professor and a wonderful technician, a humanitarian, and a wonderful genius all the way. And I was the guy with a screwdriver that could make the thing go, and he told me how, and we had a lot of fun. He took this ARC and put his microphones into the circuit and and put this music out on the air, playing around like everybody was trying to put things on the air, but it was a mistake to do it in the rough original way, so that he got down to this smooth DC ARC method. And it actually was outside of a little hissy noise.
It was
noise.
A nice, clear signal, in other words.
It was a good, we could understand every word.
Yeah, but it wasn't, Lee DeForest, as far as I know, had stumbled upon the, what turned out to be the tube back in 1906, but didn't even know what he had. And he, actually, this wasn't available to the general public or to inventors or...
No, DeForest had put the grid in the tube before this, but it hadn't been used for transmission as yet or good receiving. He was experimenting with it. Like
what did Harrell use? What did he use?
Harrell was experimenting, and he developed this ARC phone with the water-cooled transmitter.
Like the Poulsen ARC.
Used the Poulsen ARC. It's a high-frequency arc, almost inaudible to the ear. It has a little steam background.
Okay, now, is possible then to talk? Up to this time, people had heard code with exception of a few demonstrations of the fact that voice could be carried. Now, what was so unique about what you did? Why were people able to hear you? You might have been broadcasting one time and nobody could have heard it. You must have been broadcasting regularly.
Well, at first it started out we had here's the idea. We started a schedule so that we would get listeners.
Oh, you did?
We started a schedule on Wednesday nights for a half hour at 9 o'clock, 9 to 9:30 every Wednesday night. It was a ritual.
You just talked on the air or what?
Talk, news, music, whatever.
Where'd you get the news?
Oh, picked it out of the newspaper.
Did you have weather report?
Of course.
How did you get that?
Read it.
Or look out the window.
Look
huh?
out the window.
Where did this all this take place?
Right at the in the Garden City Bank Building.
Where?
In San Jose, California.
Well, a bank building, was this a very tall structure?
It was a seven-story building, and we at that time were on the third floor, and antennas were on the roof in umbrella fashion all around, pointing in all directions.
Why did you do it? But did Doc Harrell have a school there?
He had a wireless school for code.
Oh, he was teaching students the code.
And all to read the code. And later on, he was teaching war effort for wireless operators.
You did this on a weekly basis. Did it ever go daily?
Oh, yeah. The school was daily.
I mean the radio program.
The radio program came daily soon later because it was in such a demand. All the listeners would call up on the phone and tell us what they wanted to have us play.
They'd call you on the telephone?
Yes.
Well, who were these listeners? How could people hear something?
Amateurs. We had ships in the docks around San Francisco. We were well known and well heard within 50-mile radius.
You mean people who were ship's operators in the bay, in their earphones, could hear this broadcast, the music and the voices?
Right, right.
Were they surprised?
Oh, of course they were. Listen to that instead of doing their other work when we were on the record program or news.
Did he expand it at all from the half-hour program?
Yes, we went on the daily schedule as soon as it was possible to operate without getting it too hot. The arc would get hot, and we'd either blow off the air after a half an hour. Sometimes we could run an hour, depend.
Uh-huh. Now, did he perfect the system so it would stay on longer than half an hour?
Yes, he did.
And then you went daily?
That came later on again.
But how soon? A year or two?
I would say up until World War One, which we had to take the antenna down. The law prohibited any broadcasting code of any kind on account of the war effort.
Well, I've seen a picture of this station. It's a funny-looking contraption with cones and all kinds of... Well, it looked like a water-cooled microphone. It had tubes running around it to keep it cool.
Yeah.
And this was a picture taken in 1912. Were you on a daily basis then?
With the help of some of the students as operators, yes. There was Emil Portell and different boys that were students that would take over and operate on the schedule just the same, yes.
I understand that Lee DeForest was demonstrating his tube radio and transmitter at the Panama Pacific Exposition in 1915.
That's right.
You know this story where the equipment wouldn't work?
I know. I knew he has passed away, but DeForest personally, he's a wonderful pioneer and really did the greatest thing for wireless and even TV today, because he invented the third element tube, which led later on to other developments. And he had a receiver and a transmitter, mind you, experimentally for transmission. But it wasn't sufficiently pure, so that at the fair he used the San Jose ARC station for the transmitter, and he copied them or heard them on loudspeakers with amplifiers in the fair at the 1915 exposition.
In other words, Harold was the station. His station did the programming, played the music, read the news, and Lee DeForest picked it up on his receiver at the Panama Pacific Exposition.
They had daily schedules there by the hour.
Uh-huh. Did you think you had a lot of listeners in those days?
They were all over around the bay as far as they could hear us away.
And then after the war, the government took the amateurs and the private people off the air. Why was that?
All antennas were called down, out. And
security reasons?
Security, of course.
And then they went back on the air after the war.
Afterward. And then is when the call letters came out and stations increased power. By that time, the third element tube was made in larger quantity and larger output, and they would transmit up to several hundred watts.
And so after the war, then we had a lot of people putting radio stations on the air, and
yes,
they were getting licenses.
Right.
And Harold went back on as fast as he could, I assume.
He did, yes.
Now, he got call letters at the very start, or did he just call himself the Harold Station? Well, how'd you identify yourself?
We used to call it the Harold Station. This is Harold Broadcasting. Or we had a call letter at first. It was FN. That was the original call letter. For no reason at all, we took it out of the air.
Now, when the station had to get commercial licensing in 1920,
yes,
what was it called then?
That was KQW. As soon as the call letters came out in 1920, and from then on out, stations were cropping up all over.
And so that station became a full-fledged radio station that's still on the air today.
Yeah, 500-watt Western Electric went back on the air then.
And still broadcasting.
And, yes, KQW is still on the air with 50,000 now.
Uh-huh. Well, Ray, you're a real pioneer, and to think that you were in broadcasting... By the way, how old are you, Ray?
Well, I was born in 1893, the early part of 1893, so I'm on my 83rd orbit around the sun right now.
Ray, I wish we could hear those old programs. I bet they would really be wonderful. Maybe we'll hear them someday.
I've heard that, and that they bounce back from the universe. And anything is possible today. It's just got to have the luck or the ability, and it can.
Well, maybe we could even recreate a program. I brought some newspapers along here and some old phonograph records. Let's give it a try.
Okay, let's go. Hello out there. This is Doc Harrow Station calling from San Jose, California. If you hear me, call me up, please. I am Ray Newby. in the Garden City Bank building this September the 9th, 1909. Let's look at the local papers and give you a rundown on some of the things that are happening now. From the San Jose News, here are the headlines. Commander Perry tells his own story of his trip to the North Pole. Perry says Cook never got to the top of the world at all. Doc Cook declares that he found the pole and can prove it. The lie was hurled yesterday concerning the discovery of the North Pole and the foundation laid for a controversy unparalleled in history. Commander Robert E. Perry is making uncertain progress southward off the coast of Labrador in his ship, the Roosevelt. But there came from him a message. It challenges the veracity of Dr. Frederick A. Cook of Brooklyn, which further complicates a situation which the whole world is now discussing. In effect, Perry discredits Cook's claim with the intimation, hold the phone, stop the press, the intimation that Perry and he alone planted the American flag at the North Pole on April 6, 1909, and that Dr. Cook, who asserts that he unfurled the flag at the pole on April 21, 1908, must substantiate his claim that in order to prove it. Okay. Other news today. They're having a lot of trouble in Mexico. Latest news from Mexico shows that there has been an almost complete destruction of many small towns because of heavy floods. There has been a great loss of life. Railroad executive E.R. Harriman is in very grave danger from his illness, which is reported to have improved somewhat during the last 24 hours. In New York, there's a lucky man. He gave his name to the police as a mutt, M-U-T-T. He sprang from a trolley car late yesterday afternoon and dived over the rail of the Brooklyn Bridge into the East River, 130 feet below. A tugboat captain fished him out. He was unconscious, of course, but may recover. Here's a good one. Okay, let's listen to some music. I borrowed a lot of phonograph records from Sherman and Clay Music Store here in downtown San Jose. I've got here Al Jolson, George M. Cohan, Lillian Russell, Harry Lauder, Burt Williams, Weber and Fields, and so forth. What a lot of them. Here's one from that Boston beauty, Blanche Ring. Wait a minute while I turn this horn around so it faces right into this water-cooled microphone of Doc Harrell's. All right, here it is, Blanche Ring. And the song? I've got rings on my fingers. Hang on.
Gordon Greb with
Ray Newby
in San Mateo at the Wireless Pioneers Convention. Convention of the Society of Wireless Pioneers, we have operators here who have been working code on ships or airplanes or from ship to shore from 1908 right through the 1940s. With me now is a gentleman from England, Richard German, who was with a British ship, the Celtic, in 1909. Is that right, Mr. German?
That's right.
Tell me, Marconi perfected the wireless, let's say, well, he started it in 1895, and I'm told that it was probably operational for commercial reasons around 1901. This makes you one of the real early experts.
I'm one of the real pioneers,
right,
as far as the operating is concerned.
How did you happen to get into this sort of work?
Well, in 1897, I saw a demonstration of Marconi's new invention. That was the year of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. A friend of ours who was studying to be an electrician in London happened to come to our house one day, and with it he brought a suitcase full of stuff and gave a demonstration across a room of the transmission and the reception of wireless telegraph.
And then what happened?
Well, of course, I went to school up to 1906, and I was interested in wireless all that time. And in 1907, I attended the British School of Telegraphy in London, taking courses in cable telegraphy and also in wireless. I really wanted a cable job, although I'm very glad now I never did take it. But I eventually got in 1908, I got the parent company of all modern telegraphy, wireless telegraphy, the Marconi International Marine Communication Company Limited. And I served several months at that station in Liverpool, call station LV, which later became MLV and later still GLV. I mean, in 1909, I left Liverpool and went on board the Celtic White Star Liner. I made one trip to New York and back, and then I transferred to a Canadian Pacific boat, the Monmouth, that sailed from Avonmouth to Montreal in the summertime and St. John, New Brunswick in the wintertime. I spent a year and a half on her and then transferred to the Armourer, belonging to the Orient Line, to Australia, London to Australia. And I made two trips on her, and then again I transferred to I can't remember.
It'll probably come to you. But how many years did you work as a ship's operator?
Well, in England, I left England in 1913 to come to this coast.
To the Pacific Coast, California.
To the Pacific Coast, to British Columbia. And there was nothing doing. I couldn't get time for bed up in Canada. And I came down to San Francisco and joined the American Marconi Company. And my first ship there was the state of California.
Now tell me, did you work in this capacity for a good many years?
16 in all.
Were you on a ship during World War One?
Yes, I was on the... During World War One, I was on the... 14 on the Korea, belonging to the Pacific Mail Company. And I made four trips on her, and then I transferred to the Korea and made two trips on her.
Now tell me, back in the days when wireless was new, what did people think of it? Were you somewhat astounded that messages could be sent through the air without wires?
Well, I think everybody was more or less... It took Marconi quite a few years to get across the English Channel, 21 miles. And then, of course, his big break was when he got across the Atlantic to from Poldhu in Cornwall in England to somewhere near in Newfoundland. Grace Bay, I think it was, in Newfoundland.
Well, how soon did the ships acquire this? I mean, was this a rapid development after Marconi perfected it? Or was it rather rare to have a wireless on a ship?
I'll tell you, when I was working in Liverpool Station, I had to learn the code calls of every ship on the Atlantic. And I think with the British, French, German, and Italian, there probably were about not more than 100 all told. At that time, there were only 4 American ships. They were the New York, Philadelphia, St. Paul, and the St. Louis. And there was one American tanker, the Narragansett. And those were the only 5 American ships that I know of that were on the Atlantic at that time.
This would be about
1909. Of course, there were a lot of little intercoastal ships, you know, that were running up and down the coast. But I'm talking about transatlantic.
Tell me, sir, how old are you today?
I'll be 87 in November.
Can you still work the key?
Oh, I could, yeah. I certainly could.
And you could understand the wireless code if you tuned in today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would have no difficulty at all.
And how long do you belong to the Society of Wireless Pioneers?
I think it was, I don't know, probably 2 years now, I think.
What do you think about radio today? The ability to talk rather than use code.
Well, of course, that's when I was in it, there was no such thing as a radio telephone. So I don't know anything about that part of it.
It's code that you started out with.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Germain. I appreciate very much your talking to me. With me now at the Society of Wireless Pioneers Convention is Willard N. Edson. He's an operator who was on a dirigible in the early 1920s. About what time would that have been, Mr. Edson?
From 1921 until 1924, I served on dirigibles. In 1921, the greatest interest was General Mitchell's effort to convince Congress and the President's feasibility of aerial bombing and the bombing off the Virginia Capes during 1921 was a period in which I participated.
Was this the U.S. Navy or...
No, I was in
Air Corps.
It was the U.S. Army Air Corps.
Do you recall the name of the dirigible you were on?
I was on airships of the C-class, non-rigid, and of the D-class, and I was also assigned to the semi-rigid airship Roma, which crashed and burned in 1922 at the Norfolk Army Supply Base.
You weren't on it at that
time. No, I was the radio operator they left behind on the ground.
Now, you were a radio operator. Were they using the ARC at that time or the standard radio transmitter that we have today?
I'm familiar with Spark and ARC, though on board the dirigible were World War I tube, vacuum tube sets using VT-1s for receiving tubes and VT-2s for the transmitting tubes.
Now, what connection did you have, if any, with the General Mitchell project?
Just routine as a radio operator. One day, a dirigible's motors failed, so they drifted as a free balloon and landed at Maryland. But during the search period, General Mitchell did come to my radio operator station in the hangar at Langley Field, and I've had the opportunity to fly with him in the cockpit from Langley Field to Bowling Field, Washington.
Were dirigibles rather dangerous in those days?
I didn't think so.
Were they filled with helium or hydrogen?
They were filled with hydrogen.
Which is safer than the...
No,
hydrogen is the dangerous...
That's right.
Right.
When combined with oxygen, it burns.
Yes. How many crewmen would you say was on the dirigible you would be normally riding?
5.
And why did they phase them out?
I suppose the efficiency of the airplane increased, and the non-rigid ship is still used. The Goodyear blimp is still an example of a non-rigid ship.
Now, you said to me earlier you'd been an operator on a submarine. When did this happen?
I was assigned to submarines from 1925 until 1928.
How safe was that in those days?
I'm here.
Well, now I understand today you retired from United Airlines. You were a flight dispatcher. And what led to your working for the commercial airlines?
I was fortunate enough to pursue obtaining a commercial radio license. And my original license was signed by Herbert Hoover when he was Secretary of Commerce in 1924. And I was fortunate enough to have the commercial license when I got out of the Navy in 1930, at which time the predecessor company of United Airlines, Boeing Air Transport, was installing radio telephones in their mail planes, and I was one of the first employed for that purpose.
Flying with the mail plane?
No, I was a ground operator.
Ground operator.
First assigned in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Recently, the British have announced that they perfected a flying saucer. Have you seen the news on that? In other words, it's not a cigar-shaped dirigible, but apparently they're using some kind of gas to give it lift. How practical do you think that might be? Think we might return to something like that?
I doubt it very much. As an example, I flew from Chicago to San Francisco yesterday, and while on the ground at Chicago, there was a thunderstorm, and I think the currents inside a thunderstorm are so great that an airship of any considerable size would not survive.
Did you have any narrow escapes at all when you were aboard dirigibles in the early 20s?
No. The closest escape I had was probably the era of the two pilots. One was valving out air, which was a ballast. When he thought he was valving out hydrogen, so he just got heavier. And those of us considered non-essential, like radio operators, when we got close enough to the ground in our descent, jumped off, and I didn't hurt anything.
There's some who say that the Hindenburg disaster, which occurred around 1937, was sabotaged. Do you have any opinions about that?
No, I have no knowledge.
And what caused you to join the Society of Wireless Pioneers?
I've forgotten who sponsored my membership. I think it was from an article I read, and being local, that I just made an application and have found today's meeting very interesting.
Thank you very much, Mr. Edson. This is Gordon Greb in San Mateo at the Wireless Pioneers Convention.